It is my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine. I first became aware of Rabbi Lerner about 20 years ago when, as I understood it, the candidate for president, then Bill Clinton and his wife, were reading and finding real energizing thinking in a magazine called Tikkun, and I began to subscribe soon thereafter. I made my own acquaintance with Rabbi Lerner about 5 or 6 years ago when he and some other religious leaders in our land gathered the first conference of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. Inside that concept are two affirmations that I'll hold up very briefly. That persons who are drawn to the depth of reality as being spiritual have a great deal to contribute to the question of how humanity will live together, and that we are going to progress into a more just society. And therefore, that while one often finds in political discourse not much attention from the left to religious and spiritual concerns, here was a call to bring these just exactly together as scriptures so firmly and consistently demand. In Rabbi Lerner, one we have in America an extraordinarily clear voice of how heart, mind, and will join together that we may see our unity. This phrase, Tikkun Ha'olam, from Hebrew, the mending of the generations, the mending of all nations, one might say. This commitment is ours in Riverside. It is one we share with Rabbi Lerner and with that large public that he has been gathering for 20 and more years. I am eager myself to hear the calling forth of the word within through the voice of our guest, Rabbi Michael Lerner. Please give him a warm welcome.
What an honor it is for me to be here with you today. And I have been particularly falling in love with your pastor, Stephen Phelps. And want to tell you, you probably know this already, but you are so lucky to have this man as the pastor and preacher here, the senior minister. And I want to hope that I'm praying that he moves from interim to permanent pastor here. I want to start with where we are in the Torah reading in the Jewish world. As you know, we Jews divide up the Torah into portions for each week, and we begin at the Genesis, and we end at the end of Deuteronomy, and then we begin again. And where we are in at this point in our readings is with the story of Moses in Egypt and the liberation struggle that he became a leader of. And the specific part is that Moses, having had his youthful rebellion stage in Egypt, in which he rebelled against the privilege that he had grown up with, moves to Midian and sort of essentially moves to the suburbs and starts working out a life for himself, leaving behind the people who are suffering in the central city of Egypt. He is drawn at a certain point to what they say is a bush that is burning and not consumed. And there's a burning inside of him, and out of that burning he hears a message, and the message is, go back to Egypt and confront the Pharaoh and tell the Pharaoh to let our people go. And if you're familiar with the text, you'll recall that Moses' response is, you know, it would be a good thing to get them out of Egypt, but I'm not the right guy. Forget about it. You got the wrong guy, but good going, God. Do it. God argues with him, and Moses makes the point that he stutters, he's not a good speaker, he's the wrong guy, and God says, don't worry, you don't have to do this alone. You've got Aaron, your brother, and other people will come forward. But the response is not atypical for many of us who know that there are deep problems in our society, deep problems in our world, and yet we tell ourselves, when another Martin Luther King comes along, I'll join. When some incredible leader comes, I'll join. But we all have our defects, and so who are we to be able to go and confront the Pharaoh? The Pharaoh of our times, the global economic and political system that deprives so many people of their rights and their entitlements to live a decent life, a life of materials, sustenance at least, minimum sustenance. And we say, who are we? We can't get there. We can't be just like Moses. And Moses finally is confronted by God saying, forget it. You go with all your defects and with all your limitations. Others will come along with you. And it's a message for all of us that when we say, yes, there's something that needs to be transformed, and get the message from God that that is important, it's not appropriate for us to point out that we're not the right leaders. Because the truth of the matter is, there never will be the right leaders until all of us go together to try to engage in this transformation. So finally, Moses comes up with the following point. He says, look, when I go there, they're going to ask me, what's the name of this God? Who is this God? We've got, Pharaoh's got a book of all kinds of gods that are listed from all kinds of peoples that have been through Egypt. Who is this? Who are you, God? What shall I say is your name? And there is God responds to Moses by saying, Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh. The Hebrew, first, it was wildly mistranslated in the King James Version of the Bible, which says, I am who I am. But Eheyeh is I shall be. Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh, I will be whom I will be. That is to say, I am not part of the existing furniture of the universe. I'm not another object in this universe. I am that which can be. I am the force of transformation in the world. I am that which makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which can be. And in case you didn't know that that's the meaning, you can look at God's other name that God proposes, because God says to Moses, and your ancestors didn't know me that way. They knew me as El Shaddai, the God of comfort, the God of nurturance, but they didn't know me as Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Again, the King James translates that as Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. They put a J instead of the Yud and say it's Jehovah. Now, some people say Yahweh, as though this was a proper name. But actually, the name there is starts with the core vowels of Heh-Vav-Heh, which is, in Hebrew, the present tense, that which is. And when you put a yud in front of the core of the verb, it indicates future tense. So it's a concept, not a name. Jehovah, Yahweh, no. It is a concept that's saying that which is moving into that which can and should be. God is the force of transformation, the force of healing, the force that makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which ought to be. And I tell you, if you would read the Bible that way, and every time you saw the word God, you simply substituted that about the universe which makes possible the transformation from that which is to that which ought to be, you get a very different sense of that Bible, a sense of its revolutionary message, revolutionary for then and revolutionary for now. Now, if we then look at the Torah, through the lens of this God who is the force of transformation, the force that makes possible the breaking of the repetition compulsion. Now, repetition compulsion is a category developed by one of our Jewish boys, Freud, who came up with the notion that that there is this tendency, actually he just noticed it and then reported on it, the tendency that people have who have been themselves beaten down or subject to pain and cruelty, the repetition compulsion is the tendency to pass on from generation to generation the pain that was inflicted on you to pass it on to others. God is the force in the universe that makes possible the breaking or transcendence of the repetition compulsion. The central good news of the Torah is this, that the pain and cruelty that exists in the world is not ontological. It is not built into the structure of necessity. It is the pain can be overcome. The chain of pain in which people pass on to others, the pain that was given to them, can be broken so that you don't have to pass on to others that which was done to you. You can break the pain, you can break that chain of pain. What is it about the universe that makes it possible for us to overcome the repetition compulsion? Well, whatever it is, that's what we mean by God. That's what God is. God is the force. God is the force of freedom. God is the force of transformation and healing. God is the force that makes possible the repetition compulsion. If you've got that, then you can understand something else that occurs in the Torah, which is that the most frequently repeated injunction in one form or another is the following. When you come into your land, do not oppress the stranger. In Hebrew, hager, the ger. Do not oppress the stranger. I noticed it was translated as alien in the text that was read to us today. Ger is a disputed word, but it fundamentally means ki gerim ha'itim be'eretz Mitzrayim. It says because you were a ger in the land of Egypt. So what were we? We were the stranger. We were the others. We were the ones who were oppressed there. So it says, when you come into your land, over and over and over again, 34 times in the Torah, versions of this, do not oppress the stranger. That is to say, do not do to the other what was done to you. And what makes that possible, as I say, is that there is a God in the universe which is the force of transformation and healing. And who are we? According to Genesis, we were created in God's image. And so we have that same capacity to be with God as really as partners with God in the healing and transforming of the world. And the first step is to break the tendency, break the repetition compulsion, break the tendency to pass on the pain to other people. And so this is a central vision of what could be in our world. Who are the ger today? Who are the gerim today? Well, they are the powerless, the stranger, the other. Certainly in our own country, we can recognize the 12 million immigrants who don't yet have our citizenship, who are not allowed to get citizenship, and the tens of thousands, and sometimes in the past few years, hundreds of thousands, who are come here desperate for a way to make a living and instead are arrested and thrown out and sent back over the border. What does it say in the second reading that we had is, don't cut the corners of your field. Well, what's the field? The field in ancient Israel was where all the wealth came from. This is, it was a society based on agriculture, and to have land was to have wealth. That was the wealth in the ancient world, is to own land. So it says to the people who own the land, you shall not cut the corners of your field. Do not leave that for the poor. In other words, don't have your dogs or your guns or whatever it is on your borders of your land to make sure that the stranger doesn't come in and take some of what is yours. On the contrary, you have a religious obligation
to give enough to those who don't have, the homeless, the people who were down at Occupy, okay, the people who are hungry, the people who are in need in this society. As it turns out, as in the argument that I think Occupy has brilliantly put forward, that in one way or another there's a deprivation, both a material and or spiritual deprivation, for the 99% that we have to leave for them, that we have to take care of them, that this is our religious obligation. So don't take from them. You have a religious obligation to take care of them. And from this perspective, you may be able also to understand why I, as a rabbi and a lover of the state of Israel, am deeply saddened by the current reality between Israel and Palestine. As I explain in the book, in Embracing Israel-Palestine, we were with Jews who came to Israel, the land that was called by the Romans Palestine, and then was that same name taken by the British to name that land. When we came back to Palestine, starting in 1880 till the end of the Second World War, we were coming there as the strangers. We were coming there as the powerless. We were coming there as the victims of 1,800 years of Christian oppression, because every Jews were living in Christian Europe, and year after year we were assaulted by the Christian majorities who said, you killed Jesus, you killed the Son of God, you are the evil ones. And every year at Easter time, particularly on Good Friday, after the readings in which we were told, Christian world was told, the Jews did this. Over and over again, year after year, for 1,800 years, we faced assaults of violence, of murder, of rape, of pillage, thrown out from one country after another by the Christian majorities. And finally, in 1880, facing an edict from the rulers of Eastern Europe, the Alexander, who was the Tsar of Russia that had conquered much of Eastern Europe, decision to throw out all the Jews. One-third of the Jews must die, he said. One-third of the Jews must convert to Christianity, and one-third of the Jews must leave the country. So many Jews, probably if you know any Jews, most of them came between the period of 1880 to 1924 to this country. But a small percentage went to Palestine, and there we came as the immigrant, the poor, the powerless, the minority. And so we were in that situation, and would that we had been treated in the way that the scriptures calls for. But over time, and as a result of the final immense destruction of the Jewish people, in which in the 20th century, one out of every three Jews alive in the 20th century was murdered in Europe. One out of every three of us was murdered. Murdered by the Nazis, murdered in Christian Europe, murdered with much of the churches, both Protestant and Catholic, closing their eyes and doing very little to resist or to in any way to support the Jewish population. Coming there in that trauma, we then built up a society after the Second World War, which ended up switching the terms in which the Palestinians became the other, in which the Palestinians who had opposed us coming there were pushed out into refugee camps all over the Arab world. And many millions of them, the descendants of the 800,000 who were pushed out in 1948, still live in horrific conditions of powerlessness around the Arab world. And it unfortunately has switched so that our own people at times do not remember the command that when you come into your land, do not oppress the stranger. Having come as strangers, we now can't. So we can't see ourselves. In other words, we can't see ourselves that way as the new oppressors because of the experience of being oppressed. And this is the fundamental truth for both peoples, that each people sees the reality through the framework of their history. And both peoples have been subject to deep trauma. So it's much easier to deal in a situation where one side is clearly the oppressor and one side is clearly the oppressed. But the reality of Israel-Palestine is that both sides have, at one historical moment or another, been the oppressor, and both sides have been, at one point or other, the oppressed. And more importantly, both sides still see the reality in front of them through the framework of that past oppression. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is, how do we break out of this? How, here we have two people who are subject to post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Each side feeling the incredible pain of their own oppression and unable to recognize the other side and their story. And so the goal for those of us who are interested in tikkun, T-I-K-K-U-N, tikkun is the Hebrew word that means healing, repair, transformation. Those of us who are interested in tikkun have to ask ourselves, how can we deal with two sides, each of which has a story that is a legitimate story, and each of which is certain that it is the righteous victim and the other side is the evil oppressor, and then translates every activity of the other side in such a way as to reinforce the perception that they are the righteous victims and the other is the evil other. And that then legitimates, or at least in the minds of the extremists on both sides, the actions on the other side tend to give legitimacy to the extremists on the other side. Do you see what I'm talking about here? So you get this endless cycle in which each side can point to acts on the other side that have been ruthless and provocative and hurtful. Now, I don't mean to deny the unequal balance of power at this historical moment. At this moment, Israel has vastly disproportionate military and economic power, and from my standpoint, Israel has to take the first steps towards reconciliation. Now, that's what's right. But sometimes what's right isn't always what's smart. Because sometimes it makes sense to step back from saying who's in the right and who's in the wrong, and to try to stop that discourse, the discourse of the blame game in which one side or the other tries to point out, well, this one deserves more blame or this one deserves more blame, so therefore don't tell me about the other. And instead, the steps towards reconciliation, the steps towards peace, requires a transformation of the heart. Now, we saw in this situation, a similar kind of situation, about who is right and what is smart. Because in the 1960s and 70s in this country, the Black Panther Party came forward and said, you know, we as African Americans are being oppressed daily by the police in our communities, and therefore we have every right to pick up the gun and fight back and liberate the territory in our own community. And from my standpoint, from a standpoint of what was right, they were absolutely right. But Martin Luther King Jr. and thousands and thousands of others said, no, that may be right, but it is not smart. And it doesn't reflect what is needed to be reflected to the other in order to change the situation. Because what's needed to be reflected to the other is an ethos of nonviolence in which we reassure those who have power over us that when they lift their boot from our neck, we will not attempt to do the same thing to them that they did to us. That we will not be simply carrying on the movement of vengeance, of oppression, of violence, of hurtfulness. And so when Martin Luther King Jr. gives his famous speech, he doesn't give the emphasis on how bad the people are in the segregated states. Instead, he puts forward a vision that affirms the humanity of those who are in positions of oppression. And this is a critical step that those who are oppressors actually need to hear. They need to feel that they are not going to be destroyed and or wiped out should they have a change of heart. And Martin Luther King Jr. and the movement that he emerged from and became a key spokesperson for affirmed the humanity of the other, and that was critical. That strategy of nonviolence was critical towards transforming the reality. So the key is to be able to deal in a situation where you want to say, this one is evil and this one is good, to instead move to see how you can compassionately understand each side and talk to each side with that spirit of compassion and genuine love. So if we want to see peace in the Middle East, we need to have each side be able to tell the story of the other in a loving and compassionate way. We need to be able to, for each side to be able to see the side of the other and tell their story in a compassionate way. Now, at this point, you might be thinking to yourself, gee, this guy is a really nutcase here. He thinks that the reality can be changed in some fundamental way. And if you think I'm a nutcase here, let me just tell you that not only do we need that there, we need it here in this country as well. We need to develop a strategy in which we, on the one hand, we challenge the leaders, not just of the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party and the mainstream media and so forth, that continues to put forward the vision that the way to achieve homeland security is through domination and control over others, and instead affirm a different vision that says homeland security can come through a spirit of generosity and caring for the other rather than dominating the other. So this is how I had the honor to meet your Reverend Phelps, is that we at Tikkun created an organization called the Network of Spiritual Progressives. And you can find it online at spiritualprogressives.org. My guess is that most of the people in this room are spiritual progressives, but you don't know it yet. So let me tell you the central idea of the spiritual progressives. We seek a new bottom line for the United States and for the rest of the world. The new bottom line is this. Instead of defining institutions, corporations, political policies, government policies, our healthcare system, our legal system, our educational system, and even our personal behavior as efficient, rational, or productive to the extent that they maximize money or power. That's the old bottom line. Instead of just defining it that way, that corporations are seen, oh, yes, they're efficient, whatever else, they're very efficient. We have to say, no, that our vision of efficiency, rationality, and productivity, we must insist, includes the degree to which any institution or any government policy or any law or any educational policy or any healthcare policy, you can go on and on, the judicial system, et cetera, should be judged efficient, rational, and productive also to the extent that they maximize love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhance our capacity to respond to each other as embodiments of the sacred, and enhance our capacity to respond to the universe, not as some commodity to be turned into something that we can sell, but instead to respond to the universe with awe, wonder, and radical amazement at the grandeur and goodness of this incredible universe. Okay, now if the liberals were to talk in these terms, I believe we would transcend many of the differences between left and right, because there are many decent, good people on the right who have only heard a technocratic discourse from liberals and progressives, including, I'm sorry to say, our current president, only heard a technocratic discourse and have not heard the message that what we really want is a world based on love and caring and kindness and generosity and ethical and ecological sensitivity and awe and wonder at the universe. Too complicated, too long a sentence? Okay, let me give you a 5-second soundbite. We are for the caring society, caring for each other and caring for the earth. So that, okay, so now at this point, I think it's reasonable for you to be saying, well, how does that translate into anything real? And so we have introduced into Congress through Congressman Keith Ellison of Minneapolis, a global Marshall Plan. A global Marshall Plan which would dedicate 1-2% of the gross domestic product of the United States and all the other advanced industrial countries each year, 1-2% of the gross domestic product each year for the next 20, and that's all it would take to once and for all end, not alleviate, end global poverty, homelessness, hunger, inadequate education, inadequate health care. That global Marshall Plan is a possibility. It's House Resolution 157, and you can read it and read the whole plan on our website, spiritualprogressives.org. Now, when I start to talk about this, people may immediately say, well, how in the world could that ever happen in our Congress, given the way the Congress represents special interests? And for that reason, we've introduced another plan, the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the Constitution, which would do the following. Number one, it would ban all private money and all corporate money in elections altogether. So that the only money in elections should be money that comes equally to each candidate from the government, which hopefully will reduce it dramatically, and the media will be required to give equal free time and no other time to candidates. Equal free time to each candidate. Number two, it calls upon, so first of all, get money out of politics. Number two, it calls for social environmental responsibility for corporate leaders. And that means that it says that every major corporation whose income is over $100 million a year, so we're not talking about mom and pop corporations here, we're not talking about middle-sized corporations, we're talking about the big corporations, they have to get a new corporate charter once every 5 years, and that new corporate charter will only be granted to those corporations that can be, that can prove a satisfactory history of environmental and social responsibility to a jury of ordinary citizens. Now, you might say, ordinary citizens? Well, how could they make those decisions of life and death of a corporation? But we say, if you're allowing a jury of ordinary citizens to make decisions about the life and death of individuals, as they do now, and now that the corporations are claiming, hey, we're persons too, okay, go for it. Okay, now at this point you might be saying to me, Rabbi Lerner, you started out with text and it sounded very good, and now you've got this fantastic set of ideas that are so unrealistic, And so how in the world are you going to build a movement for compassion? How are you going to get a new paradigm in this country in which we talk about homeland security is based on generosity and caring? If that happened, how would it influence the Middle East? So I want to just give you a few examples, because even though most of us think, let's be realistic, it's impossible to really fundamentally change the society, certainly to change consciousness at the level that you are asking for, Rabbi Lerner, seems such a huge jump for us from anything that has ever happened. But no, my friends and congregants here, it is not true. Many of you have lived through the past 50 years in which you've seen, first of all, a tiny group of women in Boston, in New York, in Washington, in Seattle, Chicago, in Los Angeles, in London, in Paris, get together and say, we want to combat patriarchy and sexism. And almost all women, and definitely all men, said to them, are you crazy? Don't you know that patriarchy has been with us for the past 10,000 years? And you think you, this tiny little group of people here, can change things? And thank God, and I say that word meaning God, the force of healing and transformation in the universe, thank God that those women refused to be realistic. And because they refused to be realistic, the changes that have happened over the course of the past 50 years wildly exceed anything that even the most visionary of those women believed is possible, including bringing a consciousness about sexism into both the Arab world and into the Israeli world in ways that seem totally impossible. Similarly, the struggle for civil rights 50 years ago, 40 years ago, even 30 years ago, in fact, for many of the people I knew, even 7 years ago, people would have said, a black man as president of the United States will not happen. It can't happen here because the racism is so deep in the consciousness of people. Now, I don't mean to deny that racism still exists and it's still important any more than I want to deny that patriarchy and sexism still exist. But what I want to say is that the struggles to change consciousness have been monumentally effective, monumentally transformative. And when people said, even 5 years ago, LGBT, that lesbians and gays could get married someplace, everybody, even in those movements, said, wouldn't it be good enough if we could just get lesbians and gays not fired from their jobs for coming out of the closet? And now we see a transformation in consciousness in which a majority of Americans are willing to really accept and respect the rights of lesbians and gays. Transformations of consciousness that are amazing. Let me tell you that the Zionist movement itself was one such, that when Herzl started it in 1898, he was told, impossible, it'll never happen. He issued a statement, Im tirtzu chavraya ein zo agada. If the will of the people is there, it is not a fantasy. And I want to salute the Occupy movement for the tremendous impact it has had. 6 months ago in this country, people were debating what's the best way to cut the budget in order to to lower the deficit. And there was nary a voice talking about the suffering of so many people in this society. And the Occupy movement, in a very short time, in 4 months, has been able to transform public discourse in a lot of this country so that now what's now on the agenda of this country is also providing jobs, dealing with the homeless, dealing with the suffering of people. In other words, my friends, if you want to cut this down to a short little message, the message here is, don't be realistic. Do not be realistic. Now, what keeps this in place? What keeps our inability to recognize that other people all over this country, in fact, all over the world, also want a world of love, kindness, generosity, and caring? Well, the answer is that each of us has a part of us that wants it, but a part of us that doesn't believe it's possible. And so if you come away here today and say to your friends, you know, I heard this rabbi and he had something to say that seemed interesting, that we need to build a society based on love, caring, kindness, and generosity, they're likely to say to you, oh, come on, don't you know that everybody is just out for themselves? That's all people care about. What I want to tell you is, first of all, is to say to them, you know, I don't believe it's true of you. You are not just selfish and interested in your own interests. And they will probably admit that it's not true for them. It's just true for everyone else. Now, I learned this first when I talked about this to a group of 200 Methodists in Kansas at their church back many years ago. And they said to me, they loved what I talked about, but then they said to me, but Rabbi Lerner, the only people who want that kind of a world are Methodists in Kansas. I said, what makes you think that? They said, well, we read the newspapers, we watch television, we read some of the national magazines, and it's clear that the people on the coasts are merely selfish and looking out for number one. And so it's never going to work in this country. Now, conversely, when I talk about this in New York or Washington or in Seattle or in San Francisco or Los Angeles, what do people say? Oh, well, these are great ideas, but middle America, they'll never get it. You see, what is happening is that each of us Although we know that we too are torn between a part of us that wants that kind of a world and a part of us that doesn't believe it's possible, similarly, everyone else in the country is that way. In fact, almost everyone in the world. They want a new kind of reality. They want a world based on love and kindness, but they believe that they would be stupid and self-destructive if they were to base their lives on that possibility. Now, why? Because they don't know of your existence and you don't know of theirs. That's why I'm here in part, to ask you to join the Spiritual Progressives at spiritualprogressives.org. I hope you'll become part of a movement. I want you to come out of the closet as a loving and caring being, as a spiritual being, to say to your political leaders, to say to your friends, to say to whoever is shaping public opinion, no, I don't want to compromise with a world based on domination and control. I want to take my people out of Egypt. I want to take my people out of the framework in which a small group of people dominate and control all the others. I want a fundamental transformation. So I'm imploring you, don't spend the rest of your life on this planet, whether you have another 70 years or 80 years, or whether you have another 10 or 20 years. Don't spend your life focusing your energies and your attention on social or political movements or on activities that are simply realistic as defined by those who have power and tell you what's realistic. Instead, spend your rest of your life energy going for your highest vision of the good. And when people tell you that it's impossible, tell them back, this is what it means to be a Christian. This is what it means to be a Jew. It means to believe in the possibility of possibility, in the force that governs and has created this universe, that we are created in whose image we are created. It's what it means to believe in God, is to believe in the possibility of transformation from that which is to that which ought to be. And I'm not going to waste my life compromising with a reality that in its fundamentals is crooked, distorted, and oppressive. I'm going to go for my highest vision of the good. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.